Hey, True Crimers, it's your host, Jonah B., and welcome to another episode of True Crime-ish, where we try to tell the stories as true as possible around here. I really hate to say it because I do love me some money. I am my most happiest self when I have a pocket full of cash. I don't care what nobody say about money can't buy happiness, yada, yada, yada. It makes me ecstatic. But what I do hate to admit is that money does have some deep roots in evilness, and there is nothing some people won't do for that paper. Hey y'all, welcome to this beautiful Monday. And you know what makes this morning even more beautiful? It's the fact that I'm on time posting today, and I'm going to give myself a major like hand clap slash pat on the back because your girl has been struggling. I really love doing this. I love the research and the writing and the other things I'm working on behind the scenes for y'all. So when I'm not producing my best episodes that I know I can do, I get so discouraged, but we are here and we are not going anywhere. You know, I appreciate everyone who listens week to week and continues to support me and gives me constructive criticism and such positive feedback. I thank my mom and my sister Faith for constantly believing in me and encouraging me to keep going. I will not stop. And before I start crying, let's go ahead and dive into this week's episode. This is another one of those stories where it just makes the most sense to start from the beginning. So here we go. On May 17, 1935, in Pittsburgh, a Walter Sartori was born. Very little details were reported, of course, but Sartori was known to be exceptionally smart. I'm talking young Sheldon smart. He proved he was not to be played around with this school stuff when he was accepted into Carnegie Mellon University. Sartori earned his PhD in chemical engineering and went on to work at Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee. Fun fact, Oak Ridge was one of America's top secret labs where all the classified stuff went down. It was even the lab where the atomic bomb was produced. So if you get my drift, Walter Sartori was an individual with an incredibly high IQ and one who was just a heck of a problem solver. But even with these accolades, life for Walter was not a walk in the park. Outside of sounding perfect on paper, he had his own demons to fight. Sartori began to have delusions that the CIA was sending in ants to spy on him. Yes, ants. And when I thought about it, I was like, that would be mad crazy if the government did use ants to spy on us. Like, they are literally everywhere. They're the perfect little minions. But of course, there was no legitimacy to Sartori's delusions. They were just that, delusions. So Sartori, and y'all, I'm gonna say Sartori this whole episode because Walter is gone. I just like saying Sartori. So yes, Sartori was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and social anxiety. But even with these diagnoses, Sartori would go on and have a long, rewarding career with Oak Ridge and would retire 30 years later. As a retired man, Sartori could not just sit idle. He never started a family. His disorders prevented him from making friends. Both his mom and dad had passed, and him and his one sister were estranged. So what did retired life look like for Walter? It looked like getting to another bag. Sartori had moved from Tennessee to Hebron, Kentucky to live his small yet reclusive life. And here is where Sartori had a living room full of computers. Half the computers working on an algorithm for the stock market and the other half searching for more research on life beyond space. And if that was not enough, Sartori also had time to secure three major patents on algorithms and medical devices, all leading him to a mass fortune of approximately $16 million at the time. Walter was a genius, a scientist, a millionaire, but also a loner. After going to therapy, Satori had decided to open up just a tad. See, he believed that most humans had bad intentions and would harm him if given the chance. So his whole thing was to keep his distance from others, hence why he became a recluse. But eventually, Satori began chatting in online chat rooms. He eventually joined an online mental health forum where he met others who would become an integral part of his life. He had finally made friends. One friend in particular was Anne Carty, who lived in Sterling, Virginia. Satori became close friends with both Anne and her husband, and Satori had visited them many times, spending vacations and holidays with the couple. Anne and Satori were great friends and spoke every day, multiple times throughout the day, whether through email or phone. And may I add, I cannot wait to be retired so I can actually finally, you know, just talk to my friends, because I swear I don't get to as much as I would like to, but they know I heart them all. But anywho, it was this connection that would bring some major truths to light. As I said, Anne and Satori talked every day, multiple times a day. So Anne had became beyond concerned when she had not heard from Satori for a whole week. The last time Anne spoke to Satori was on February 16, 2009, when he was headed back into Kentucky coming from a science conference. Anne waited until March 2nd until she decided she could not take it anymore. Her worries were beginning to consume her. On March 2nd, 2009, Anne and her husband called the Boone County Sheriff's Department and explained to them why they were concerned and asked the sheriffs to go complete a wellness check. The sheriff department obliged and went out to the home, but found that there was no one there. And on this part, I'm not sure if Anne called again, but the sheriff went out again a few days later to complete another wellness check. And once again, no one was home. But this time, the sheriff decided to go inside the unlocked door. Once inside, there was no one there, of course, but the sheriff did see multiple medications that screamed mental health issues, so the worry had increased a little bit more. And after talking with Anne again, the sheriff department knew what they had to do. Anne had turned over the last email that she had received from Walter Satori. The email entailed how Satori had a run-in with a shady cleaning lady. Apparently, when Satori was coming back from out of town, coming in from one of his many, many conferences that he loved to go to, he returned home to his driveway being completely shoveled of the large amount of snow that he left there, and even more snow had fell since he had been gone. So he comes back home and his driveway is completely shoveled, which would not have been so odd if Satori did not like look and see that his neighbor's driveways were not shoveled. So this was like not a neighborly deed. You know, at first I would have been thinking, oh, look at my neighbor helping me out, I'm old. But no, they didn't even did their own little driveway. So a few days later, Satori was met by a woman at his door holding a stack of his own mail, explaining that she was a cleaner of other homes in the area, and it was her that had her son shovel his driveway as a sign of good faith if Satori were to hire her to be his cleaning lady. Satori was not interested, but offered to pay the lady for her service. The woman refused the money, but kind of just let herself in and continued to try to convince Satori for the next 2 hours that she is the cleaning lady for him. And y'all know Satori has major social issues, so the whole ordeal left him, you know, shook and feeling a little violated. And violated enough to write a detailed email stating what happened and how he did not trust this lady one bit. He stated that he might be being paranoid, but he believes that that woman was, in so many words, basically trying to case his home, see if it was worth robbing or not. And just to the sheriff's luck, Satori had included a name. The name of this cleaning woman was Willa Blunk, and the sheriffs were ready to go ahead and pay her a visit. The sheriffs locate Willa and My grandmama's name was Willa, and I really ain't know it was other Willas out here in this world, but the sheriff's located Willa Blanc in Union, Kentucky, which is like 15 minutes from Hebron, Kentucky, where Walter Sartori stays. Willa Blanc stayed in a nice home with her husband, Paul Blanc, and her 27-year-old son, Lewis Wilkinson. Willa was like completely unbothered by the cops' appearance and answered their questions with ease. When she was asked when the last time she saw Sartori, Willa explains how both her and Walter were really good friends. She stated how she actually had seen him 2 days prior at a shopping center not too far from his home, and Sartori had told her that he was headed to Kroger and then back to his house. Willa assured the cops that Sartori was just fine. She said that he loved to travel a lot and will probably be back any day now. And that was that. Before we go further, I just want to give a little insight on Willa. As usual, very little is known, but I will report what I got. For starters, Willa was born Glenn Willa Crawford on June 19th, 1971 in Cincinnati. Reports said that she grew up in a particularly wealthy family, but by the age of 13, she had lost both of her parents and sibling. Because of this, Willa had to go into survival mode. She had her own apartment at 15 and was welcoming in her son, Lewis, at 19. Down the line, she met Paul after being his cleaner, and months after knowing one another, the two got married. And Willa and Lewis moved on in. At the time that Willa was receiving a visit from the cops, their $290,000 home was being foreclosed on due to Willa's extreme gambling debts. And from what I can tell, from the outside looking in, Willa was constantly trying to live beyond their means, even having a red Corvette parked in the driveway once the investigators pulled up. Apparently, Willa just wanted to live a luxurious life. I feel you, sis. But she was willing to do anything to maintain it. At one point during the investigation, the cops were conducting another search of Sartori's home, just looking for anything that could help at this point, since there were still no leads as to where Sartori may be. One of the sheriffs checked the mail and finds a piece of mail from Fidelity Investments. And something finally clicks in his head where he was like, you know, let's follow the money and see what turns up. And I don't know why that was not done from the beginning, but subpoenas to get bank statements were sent off. And when records came back, the initial thoughts of Sartori coming back alive began to dim. Once the sheriffs realized how much Sartori was worth, theories began to whirl as to what the heck was happening. Then, after further digging, the investigators see something interesting. During this time that Sartori had been missing, wires were being sent from his account. The first wire was for the amount of $10,000, and the second wire was for $200,000. And if that was not damning enough, the cops saw that a power of attorney had been added to multiple of Sartori's accounts, all during this time that he had been, quote unquote, missing. And once the investigators saw the name that had been listed as POA, their jaw dropped. Our dear sis, Willa Blanc, was newly listed as Sartori's power of attorney and was set to inherit 60% of Sartori's wealth at the event of his death. The last straw was when Willa tried to draw $1.3 million of Sartori's dollars from his investment account. But the gag was up when she was told that the account had been frozen. And here began the descent of Willa Blanc. Obviously now, detectives wanted to speak with Willa again, but when they went to her home, she wasn't there. So detectives turned their attention to Willa's husband, Paul Blanc. They didn't know if he was involved or not, so they just went ahead, you know, let me just go ahead and throw some questions at him and see what he say. Paul told them what we know, how he met Willa in 2001 after she was hired to be his house cleaner. He told the detectives how he was attracted to her poise and flashy appearance. I don't know how you can be both, but After a few months of dating, we know that they got married and Willa and Lewis moved into Paul's home. Paul said that Willa was a thrill seeker and she loved fast cars and had a habit for gambling. Willa ran up $500,000 in debt because of her gambling addiction at this point, and as a result, they had defaulted on their mortgage. He told the cops that he let Willa handle all the finances, and he was actually shocked to find out that their home was about to be repossessed. And I'm not sure what prompted this comment, but Paul then tells detectives that on the morning of February 22nd, 2009, while she was in Indiana doing her usual gambling bids, Willa ended up totaling his Chevrolet Trailblazer. And when officers responded to the crash, they noticed a large, heavy-looking trash can in the back of her truck. When they asked her what it was, she said it was full of firewood for a friend named Dwayne Lively, just throwing out full government names there. At the scene, Willa called Lewis, and he rented a minivan to come pick up her and the trash can. And if you ask me, when I see a heavy looking trash can in someone's trunk, my mind immediately goes to body. It has to be a body in there. And maybe I'm just too paranoid, or maybe I'm just too much of a true crime podcaster, but that's just what I would have thought. But that night, I guess the police didn't see a reason to ask her to open the trash can, or they didn't feel like she was lying when she said it was just firewood. So The whole scene is just really fishy to me. But anywho, the Chevy Trailblazer was actually towed back to a Chevy car dealership in Kentucky. And that concludes the interview with Paul. But now the investigators wanted to speak with the car dealership manager. When detectives followed up with the dealership, they were made aware of a very strange encounter sales manager John Perron had with Willa and Lewis. He said on February 17th, Willa came to the dealership and she wanted to purchase a new 2009 Corvette, telling John that she was about to come into some big money really soon. In the midst of them talking, Lewis came in and whispered to Willa, and I quote, "Mom, the old man wants to get out the car," end quote. John said, you know, he got up and looked outside and he could see an older gentleman in the back seat who was wearing glasses. Willa told Lewis, and I quote again, "Tell him to stay in the bleeping car or he'll pay for it later," end quote. So naturally, detectives wanted to talk back with Willa. They bring her back in for questioning, and this time they bring up the whole power of attorney thing. She said, yeah, you know, she was power of attorney, but she hadn't actually used it. And detectives already knew that, you know, like, girl, you lying. So they went ahead and asked her about the trash can, and she's like, oh, it must have been stolen or something, which no one believes, of course. Detectives' next move was to track down this Dwayne Lively person to see what he had to say about this whole trash can and firewood situation that Willa was telling folks about. So on March 13, 2009, they finally tracked him down. They asked him how he met Willa, and he said he met Willa at a casino in January. He did confirm that Willa and Lewis did come to see him, but it had nothing to do with firewood. He said they asked him to help him get rid of a trash can because it had a dead dog in it that Lewis had hit. Willa also said that the dog belonged to an elderly man that she was taking care of, so they just wanted to get rid of it, you know, discreetly. So Dwayne was like, oh yeah, you know, you can bury the dog in my backyard, that ain't no issue. But Willa was like, oh no, we need to burn it. Then she offered Dwayne $1,000 to take it to a field and do just that. That night, Willa, Louise, and why I be calling this man Louise, Lewis, and Dwayne drove to Dwayne's cousin's farm, poured gasoline on the trash can, and for hours on end, the three of them just watched it burn. At one point, Dwayne said he thought he saw part of a spine, and he told Willa, "This better be a dog." And if y'all feel like if you gotta say that, something ain't right. Would you really believe that there was a dead dog in a trash can and it just had to be burned? Yo, like, not even good friend, your little gambling friend comes up to you asking you to burn something and you just do it, no questions asked. Would you really do this? Y'all, I need to know if I'm going too far with this. Comment your response on our Instas. But that same day, Dwayne took detectives down to the field where they burned the trash can. As detectives were kicking around some of the ashes, one of the detectives found a human bone. Indiana and Ohio forensic experts were called to the scene where they discovered a large amount of bone. Y'all, it took forensics 6 to 7 large bags to collect all the remains. When they ran the DNA, it came back belonging to who we already know, Walter Sartori. Of course you know now, detectives had it to pick up Willa and Lewis. FYI, Dwayne Lively fully cooperated with authorities and was not arrested. So in the early hours of March 14, 2009, Willa and Lewis were arrested and charged with kidnapping, murder, knowing abuse or neglect of an adult, knowing exploitation of an adult, tampering with physical evidence, abuse of a corpse, and theft by deception. Willa immediately contacts her lawyer, and by his request, she lets detectives know that she can't say anything. My lawyer told me not to talk. But Lewis, on the other hand, it didn't take much for detectives to get the truth out of him. Like, all they had to do was sit him down and ask him a question. And he was like, okay, let me tell you everything. It wasn't long after he sat down in that interrogation chair that Lewis just started spilling. He said, and I quote, "I had no control. I'm just a weak person. I need help. She knew I needed psychiatric help. I wasn't strong enough. She's bad. She's bad. She's bad." End quote. He said around the middle of February, his mom called him over, and when he got there, he found Walter Sartori in the basement, duct taped in a chair by his hands, feet, and mouth. Willa told Lewis that she needed him to stay in the basement and take care of Walter. Lewis says she went back upstairs and deadbolted the door, leaving him and Walter in the basement. Lewis went on to say that he did what his mother asked, and he began to care for Walter. He said that Willa would come down with food and water, but every time he fed it to Walter, he would throw up, leading detectives to believe that he was being poisoned and eventually died from it. Lewis told detectives he wasn't sure when Walter died. He only said she is the person that who would know, she being Willa. He said that Paul didn't know what was going on inside the home. Turns out Paul had just had gotten surgery for a leg amputation, so he couldn't even move. He was confined to the couch. Lewis said that his mom made him do those things and he couldn't break away from her. But detectives reiterated that, hey now, you know, you a grown man. You could have left at any point. After Lewis's statements, detective obtained a search warrant for Willa's house and car. When they searched her home, they located a book titled, and I quote, "How to Choose Your Prey." And what is that even doing being a book? But she had it. And they also searched her car and found a picture of Walter, his financial statements from Fidelity Bank, and a black semi-automatic handgun. Bank employees told them Willa brought in an imposter to pose as Walter, and he signed over the documents that gave Willa power of attorney. I'm not sure how true that is, because how many like old white fragile men do you know to come in and pretend to be in their signing papers? Like, not sure, but the man was not ever identified. On April 13th, my sister's birthday, forensics finally confirmed that the remains belonged to Walter. But because of the condition of the remains, the medical examiner couldn't determine his cause of death. On May 12th, a Kentucky grand jury indicted both Willa and Lewis on multiple charges. And that was essentially all the state and prosecutors needed to file a motion to seek the death penalty against Willa. With the death penalty on the table, in December of 2011, Willa took a plea deal. She pled guilty to all charges And in January 2012, she was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole instead of death. Apparently, with the plea deal, she was supposed to, you know, lay out exactly what happened from A to Z. But apparently, she gave just enough information where she could still get the plea deal, but not enough information because we still don't know when Walter was kidnapped or how he actually died or how he was kidnapped or how she got up in that basement. We still don't know any of that, but she is currently serving out her life sentence at the Kentucky Correctional Institute for Women. The following September, Lewis also pleaded guilty to kidnapping, abuse of a corpse, and exploitation of an adult. In September 2012, he was sentenced to 30 years in prison. He will be eligible for parole in 2029. By then, he'll be 47, and 2029 is really around the corner. And I don't know how I feel about him getting parole. Yes, he was just doing his mom's bidding, but since when is that an excuse? But that does conclude this week's episode, and I just wanted to just leave off with some kind words about Walter. Although Walter suffered from debilitating mental health issues, he was still a nice person to the people that he worked with and the few friends that he did have. Even though he was a loner, he made unimaginable contributions to the world we live in today. And, you know, he just deserves his recognition for that. Even with the trial and tribulations, he still managed to make his mark on this world, which in turn made it a better place. Fortunately, the rest of Walter's estate went to friends and organizations that he specified in his will. Walter truly did care about people, just in his own way. And what's the most tragic thing about this case to me is that Walter's biggest fear was people being after him. And to fall victim to that very fear is absolutely heartbreaking. His sense of safety was never fulfilled. And that made him vulnerable to people like Willa, a predator literally stalking her prey. And like when you just look at Willa, or when I see Willa just being this small little thing, I could never just like guess that this amount of evil like just was lodged into her heart, that she was honestly willing to do anything for a dollar. I don't want to say it's unimaginable because people do strange things for change all the time, but just stop making this cliche so real. I, for one, who think that having money and having things does not necessarily have to change people or change who you are or make you like so greedy that you are willing to do anything to maintain that lifestyle. I just think that Willa is honestly the worst type of person, but let me get off of my judgy box. That concludes this week's case. Just like, you know, the usual money made me do it story. And I thank you guys for tuning in and for listening. And I cannot wait to have you guys back next Monday. And until then, bye.